entertainment.ie.
I love the way you say film.
Hello, very welcome to the film show. I'm Mike Sheridan and I'm joined by Brian Lloyd. We've no Dean Mullumby this week.
And the gap is noticeable.
Maybe on Ronan, who's editing the show, the video this week, could do like a CGI. Could we do like a CGI D? You know, or, or we could like, you know, what's that thing they did? Like Tupac did at the hologram. Hologram D from Holidays. Sitting on a balcony somewhere and been like, no, Brian, this is what you do.
Yeah.
No, Brian, this is what the film's called. Yeah, no, yeah. Brian, this is what's out next week.
Yeah. Yeah, we could like link it in with Wikipedia and just have it like correct me every so often. Just this hologram that will be here.
You know, like fake news. Fake news when you say something that's not true. Anyway, we're joined by producer Dave on the microphone, though. Hello.
Hello.
So anybody at home, which still makes me laugh, the word hello inexplicably from producer Dave makes me laugh.
Deadpan Dave.
Deadpan Dave. Because we wanted the world to hear your dulcet tones.
Thank you. I have appropriated Dee's microphone.
It's mine now, and she's not getting it back.
You're going to crack wise then. You're going to jump in and crack wise, and be the D. You're going to be the Deirdre Mullumby.
Pretty much.
But just off camera because you're multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yes.
Makes sense.
Be the comedic foil.
Be the comedic foil, yeah.
The comedic foil, as it were.
I don't know. I think we'd probably be the straight man to his deadpan.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, this week, Brian, there's only one real major release out this week. It's Ant-Man and the Wasp. We know you've seen this one
because yes, I have.
We've discussed that great detail, the junket that you did.
Yeah.
The hug that Paul Rudd gave you.
Uh-huh.
Your face to that subsequent hug. Grammatically, I don't even know if that makes sense. It's been a
long
day.
Sure.
So yeah, we all know. We've all seen it. Hundreds of thousands of people have seen it because the clip kind of went viral.
Uh-huh.
Is the film any use?
Yeah, it's all right.
Cut to the chase, Brian.
No, genuinely, it is grand. It's perfectly grand. It's 3.5 out of 5. It's a 7 out of 10. It is not...
That's a solid, right?
That's what I'm saying.
The first one was a 3.
Yeah. I mean, like, the first one, definitely, there was the whole kind of thing with Edgar Wright and the fact that he basically walked off the set just as they were about to start filming. And then Peyton Reed, who ended up directing the first one and directed this one, he was basically drafted in at the 11th hour to kind of get the thing over the line. So... when you're watching the first one, you're always kind of thinking, God, I wonder what this would have been like if Edgar Wright had got directed. Do you know that kind
yeah.
of way? You're always kind of looking at it and thinking, what if?
Lots
what
of heavy if. Cuts.
Yeah, lots of heavy and cuts, like, lots
indulgence.
Of music. Indulgence.
That's a homage.
Well, like, yeah.
Shit, Edgar Wright.
All right.
Your homages.
All right.
You're too old for that haircut as well. Anyway, sorry.
In fairness, yeah, I'll give you that, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, like, Edgar Wright was basically responsible for, you know, bringing Paul Rudd on board, bringing Evangeline Lilly on board.
Oh, he did. So he did all the cast.
He did all the cast and pretty much got everything kind of up and running. And then when it kind of the Marvel machine at that time started to kick against him, he just said, right, screw this, and he left.
So what phase was that? Was like, just the
phase 2, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the one just after...
phase 1.
Age of Ultron.
That's
I was
why
gonna
he's here.
Say.
That's why he's here.
Comedic foil. Yeah, comedic foil. Deadpan Dave. After Age of Ultron. I'm afraid you're just going to jump him.
Imagine he just snapped one day.
Who, me?
No, Dave. And I went, you snap like 6 or 7 times a day.
True. This is fair.
You snapped earlier on about something, you know, not in a violent way. It's never in a violent. Your bark is way much worse than your bite. But one of the guys who's only occasionally in the offices part-time was like, and he was so quiet today as you walked past.
Anywho.
I was referring to Dave.
Anywho. What was I talking about?
Phase 1, phase 2.
Yeah, phase 2. Yeah, it was, the first Ant-Man was just after Age of Ultron, I think it was. So, and again, like in Age of Ultron and like in this, there's always a sense of like, okay, how do we actually manage to make this film relevant and entertaining when it's up against some big, huge world-ending blockbuster?
So this is the first one you're talking about, or the second one?
This is the first one, and it's the same with the second one.
So you go, okay, so you go, you've got Paul Rudd,
yeah,
endlessly charming. You've got Michael Douglas for that kind of old school vibe. You've got Evangeline Lilly, who's very fussy about what she does now.
Yeah.
I know, because you spoke to her, you were talking about how she basically retired.
Yeah.
After Lost, came back for The Hobbit because she wanted to be a screenwriter.
Yeah.
That's what she wanted to segue.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. When you'll see it in the interview when I talked to her. She basically discussed about the fact that, you know, she had more or less given up on acting. She was happy enough to kind of stay out of the game and just write screenplays and hope to get them made. She hasn't got one made yet, but she's getting close to it. Yeah, like she, and this was all Edgar Wright who had gotten these people together. Like, so
solid cast.
Very solid cast. Yeah, very, very solid cast.
Michael Pena.
Awesome. Michael Pena as well, like, steals the scene, every scene he's in, and he's not in it that much. They're very smart with him in the sense that they only kind of deploy him when there's a bit of a lull and he can just bring this
Scientology energy.
I forget that he's a Scientologist. Yeah, true. But you didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you know who else is a Scientologist? Elizabeth Moss from The Handmaid's Tale.
I knew that. I've actually seen
The Handmaid's Tale.
I watched one episode of the first episode of the second season.
And it's dark.
That's
it. Grim.
That was, and like Fiona Flynn was saying, it's a particularly dark episode.
Yeah.
No bueno.
Yeah, no, it's grim.
No, thank you. But the one thing that's drawn me towards the sequel, like actually physically paying cash money.
Sure.
To see the sequel is Paul Rudd.
Yeah. I mean, he's brilliant. I mean, like, this is it. Like,
he's like an effortless charm and warmth.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of like that in real life.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But I mean, more than that as well is the fact that you're kind of like, you know, when it's Robert Downey Jr. or if it's even Chris Pratt or if it's, you know, Chris Evans, any of the kind of the Marvel people, you're kind of looking at them thinking, they look like superheroes. Like, you just look at them and think, yeah, of course Robert Downey Jr. is going to play Tony Stark. He looks like a superhero.
Chris Pratt's a good looking guy, right? But Chris Pratt looks like that lad who was the hero in school, somewhere like Cork, somewhere like where you're from, producer Dave.
Lovely.
And he was a GAA hero. But, you know, since he left school, he's gotten a bit out of shape.
Right.
Doesn't play the guy anymore. You know, but still a good looking bloke, though. Still a solid good looking bloke, you know? Wears the North Face tops to hide the gut.
I wear a North Face jacket, so you're saying I've got to go?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah. this is how I wanted to break it to you. Brian, this is an intervention.
Am I fat?
There isn't even cameras here.
There's no. They said a camera adds £10. Well, how many cameras are on me? Three.
Stop eating cameras.
Those cameras aren't even on. That light is the off light.
Okay. Anyways.
Beautiful, Brian. I think you're beautiful. Inside and out.
Don't touch me.
Inside and out.
Don't. Your hands are all clammy. What are you doing? Anyways.
I'm excited.
We've gone so off track. With all the other actors, I think they have movie star quality. You know, that kind of
way.
You just know what
they've all carried movies on their own or could carry movies on
exactly.
their own.
Exactly. But with Paul Rudd, I mean, we know him as a comedic actor. We know him either as part of an ensemble or we know him from stuff like I Love You Man or Role Models or any of those kind of things. In this, the charm of it is seeing him kind of interact with that kind of superhero apparatus.
Yeah.
As in, like, he's, oh my God, it's Paul Rudd, the superhero. How is that going to work?
No, that's why we're in Civil War. Him kind of throwing Rudd in Civil War was like, oh, it's Paul Rudd.
Yeah, it's literally, that's when he turned up. It's like, oh my God, it's Paul Rudd. What's he doing here kind of thing? And he's hilarious in it. And the same here as well. It's just that extrapolated out. Now, Evangeline Lilly, you can kind of totally see her as a badass. Like, I mean, if they were going to...
She looks athletic. She's,
100%.
Yeah.
Like, if they were, tomorrow, if they were going to recast Sarah Connor in
Terminator,
she'd be my number one pick. 100%. She would just be perfect for that role. She's got that real kind of like, she looks like she could beat the crap out of you. And that works. And that
kind of sounds like you're into that, Brian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
My talk is there. I'm sorry.
But the dynamic between the two of them is brilliant because, like, she's the straight man, essentially. And he's, you know, the comedic foil.
But she's got a much bigger role in this one, right? That was the whole thing.
That was the whole thing, though, that this has been sold on. The fact is that the two of them are equals in this.
Yeah.
As opposed to her just being a sidekick. And I think another part of this as well is the fact that if you had a different actor in the role of the Wasp, I don't think they would have done as good a job of it as she has. Because... like I say, it's because these movies are so kind of not chaotic, but they're just so bam, 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 plot, 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 just moving along.
Because they're all part of this much bigger universe.
Exactly.
And they need to be pieces that, we'll have their own thing going on.
Yeah.
So you need to, at the end of the day, come in for that post-credit sequence, all of that.
Exactly.
To lead to the next thing.
Exactly.
Part of that universe.
Exactly. And that's it. I mean, the fact that she's able to kind of, I guess you would say, ingratiate herself to it and make herself a part of it, I think really does stand to her screen presence.
Do you think we're going to see another Ant-Man? Because this one's done better than the first one.
But I mean,
marginally so, but still has done better. That's rare for sequels.
It is, very much so, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is going to kind of come down to what happens with the fourth Avengers and stuff like that. Like, I mean, apparently Paul Rudd is going to have a bigger role in it.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. I'd say there probably will, yeah.
I would have liked Infinity Wars more.
If Paul would have been in it,
I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think
needed that bit of levity.
You see, that's just it. Like, I mean,
I think that was Thor.
Yeah.
That was Thor, yeah, exactly. And that was like Guardians of the Galaxy. They were the levity, you know what I mean? Dave Bautista.
Is Chris Hemsworth not too jacked to be like kind of the lulls bringer? No, I mean, I think he's really funny as well. No. But like, it's Thor, you know?
No,
like,
come on, no. Look at Thor Ragnarok. Yeah. He was hilarious in that.
Yeah.
I grew up like reading the comics and Thor was like minus crack.
Oh yeah,
that's what I mean though.
So was Ant-Man as well.
Thor was just, I think
they kind of realised they needed to change things around with Thor.
There you go.
And they did. And Ragnarok is probably my favourite Marvel film, I'd say.
Mm.
And that's why they started down that route with Ant-Man as well, because Hank Pym is like even worse.
Is that what happened with Tony Stark as well? The film that kind of started it all in Iron Man, because was that Robert Downey Jr.'s casting? Because I know Tony Stark was a playboy.
Yeah. So, but he was kind of, yeah, he was still very serious. Like, I mean, there was an entire comic book, so you remember this. What was it? Demon in a Glass Bottle or something like that. Yeah. Wasn't that what it's called or something?
Volume 2, Episode 3. Yeah.
Anyways, there was a comic book storyline in Iron Man where he became an alcoholic. Like, so it got really serious. Like, but yeah, producer Dave is absolutely right. You look at the two of them characters in, you know, the sort of the genesis of where they came from.
Yeah.
Like, you look at the first Thor that was directed by Kenneth Branagh. And it was basically
forget that, don't you?
He made
a Jack Ryan movie after that and nobody went to see it.
Nobody went to see it. The Shadow Recruiting was muck. But like, you look at the first Thor, it's basically like a Shakespeare film. Literally, the way they talk, just all of it, it's very Shakespeare-esque.
Natalie Portman as well.
Yeah. And then the second one was just kind of like, they got Alan Taylor in because he did a lot of work on Game of Thrones and they thought, right, we'll just make Game of Thrones.
Terminator Genesis, then after that.
And then with Thor Ragnarok, they were like, okay, we have no idea what to do with this. Let's just get Taika Waititi in and just give it to him and see what he does. And he came back with the best one because Taika Waititi fundamentally understood, and this is what Peyton Reed got as well, is the fact that when you've got these characters that, you know, nothing has really kind of worked for them, the best way to go about it is to basically lower the stakes dramatically. You know, it doesn't have to be this huge world-ending thing. It can just be like one self-contained story in a larger kind of scope. Which is what Ant-Man and the Wasp is. Ant-Man and the Wasp is just a completely self-contained story. There are no kind of repercussions.
This one is set directly before Infinity War.
Exactly,
yeah. Okay.
So there are no kind of
massive... Because a lot of people are going to be like, how does...
Yeah.
We don't give anything away at the end of Infinity War, but everyone dies. Everyone.
Pretty much. And that's it. Like, so when it comes into this one, immediately you know the tone is going to be lighter. There's no world-ending problem that they've got to solve because that gets kind of boring after a while.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you can't constantly be saving the world. Like, it's the problem, like, not to kind of go off on a tangent, but the problem with the DC...
That's what this show is based on.
Tangents, completely. No, but the problem I always found with the DC Expanded Universe, if you like, is that every single film, there was some world-ending problem. Like, a Man of Steel, it was... What's his face? Michael Shannon come down to kill everybody. Then Batman versus Superman, it was more of the same. And then with Suicide Squad, more of the same. So rather than kind of it constantly, the world being in peril, you could just have a self-contained story like Ant-Man and the Wasp and make it nice and clean and tidy.
See, it's something as well, because we revisited Way to Gun last week and reviewed Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yeah.
And it's something that, because I didn't get a chance to rewatch Way of the Gun until this week.
Yeah.
But it's something that I noticed that Chris McQuarrie does incredibly well, and he does it very, very well in Fallout too, and that there's all these multiple threads.
Yeah.
And these layers plots, and it's a franchise and needs to kind of reference stuff that had gone on before.
Yeah.
And continue going forward. Now he is incredibly good at structuring that, as a screenplay,
keeping the plate spinning,
and still making those action sequences work. And it's something that I think you said, where you said that every one of those action sequences had a beat, like it was a story, like it was a character. Yeah. And that's like, I mean, that's something that the Marvel Universe, I think, has been missing.
You think?
Yeah, I think in some of the films, I think Civil War. I thought the second one was Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
I think that's the most enjoyable Marvel film so far. I like Frank Grillo as well. I think he's really cool. He's a really cool villain. He's underutilized going forward. That's obviously just, it was a crossbones?
Crossbones, yeah.
Crossbones that he played. But I thought that the Russo brothers just had a really unique look for that.
Yeah.
It felt 70s. It felt, you know, that kind of espionage.
Conspiracy thriller, yeah.
So that, for me, from what you're saying, that's the one film that, I mean, I've enjoyed some of the more, enjoyed the Guardians of the Galaxy probably the best of the bunch, but that's the one film that had its own unique feel to it while still propelling the rest of the series forward, the film into that broader universe.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you wanted to compare Ant-Man and the Wasp to an existing film already, I'd put it somewhere in the region of Innerspace. In the sense that, I mean, not just for the fact that they're shrinking down, it's not just that, but the sense of, like, there's a real kind of confident swagger in it, you know, that kind of way. It's very assured of itself. It very much knows what it's doing. And like in an inner space, Dennis Quaid, he was a guy that even if he didn't know what he was doing, he made it look like he knew what he was doing. And that's what Paul Rudd does in this.
Dennis Quaid was really good at that, wasn't he?
He was so good at that. Yeah. He was brilliant. Like, even in like Any Given Sunday, it was the same. Like, he's a really underrated actor.
I like that movie.
And yeah, right.
Sports movies.
So good.
That was supposed to be David Duchovny playing that role in Any Given Sunday, but there's a scheduling conflict with the X-Files. Yeah. Playing the quarterback. Yeah.
Jeez.
It's going to be David Duchovny.
That would have been terrible.
Why?
I feel it would have been poor, yeah.
It would have been. That was such a bad choice.
Dennis Quaid is perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, he's great, miss. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just like, what's wrong with David Duchovny's Mulder? What's your problem?
I know, yeah.
Mulder
can do
anything. It's not to do with Mulder.
It's not about Mulder. Mulder's a great character. David Duchovny, great actor. But David Duchovny as a quarterback, I don't see it.
He's like good-looking and athletic. Is that not the thing?
Well, see, a quarterback who's kind of on his last legs becoming a down and outer, like that was Dennis Quaid in that. Mulder looks too healthy to play that role.
Tom Welling played a quarterback in, it was a Draft Day.
Yeah, the one with Kevin Costner.
The one with Kevin Costner, Ivan Reitman directed. Yeah. It was a Draft Day, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Did that even get released in
Ireland? It's a solid film. Jennifer Garner's in it as well. But Tom Welling plays an Asian quarterback. You're like, that's Superman. Don't give me that.
Yeah, but like, I mean, okay, right, because I don't really watch NFL. Like, am I right in saying the quarterbacks don't have a long shelf life?
Well, Tom Brady.
Some quarterbacks have very long ones. But like, the ones that were, say, like, the age that Dennis Quaid obviously was in that film, like, they look about as kind of weather.
So that was good. That was really good casting.
I thought he was brilliant casting. Yeah. Like when he was like getting up and like holding his shoulder and stuff, that getting crushed, it looked like
Dennis Quaid as well, as like he's in Great Nick, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
So he's got the whole, he needed a rookie as well. He's like these aging baseball player.
Yeah, that's it. Like that aging. Was his whole shtick. Yeah. But like he does it well.
Yeah.
I mean, he does it well. He's solid in everything he does. And even in an inner space.
Is that the thing where they're like in the bloodstream?
Yeah.
Rick Moranis, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
It's Martin Short.
Martin Short, Innerspace.
I love that film shrinking. As a kid.
Yeah, and Innerspace.
It was one of those things that years later I thought I dreamt it because it was so ridiculous.
I need to write this down. I had a screenplay here that could work. So solid 3.5 stars.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see how well it does in Ireland.
I think it'll do all right.
Because I think there's been so many blockbusters back to back now as well. And Mission Impossible Fallout has really, really strong.
And Mamma Mia is still in there.
Mamma Mia is bringing in the coin.
2.3 million this week.
Okay, so we're going to be a little leaner, a little bit tighter this week. So we're not going to do as many movie news stories.
But
we're going to do one. Well, I mean, it's a bigger story before we get to the revisit, which is Mission Impossible, as we said. We're recording this on Tuesday, so things could have changed dramatically by the time this goes out, and we're going to look like idiots. But so that's just the context of why we're talking about it now. So late last night, the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy, like the main cast, Zoe Saldana, Chris Pratt, Dave Bautista,
but also
Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel, like, not that you forget, they're in it. Vin Diesel, you kind of forget that.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
But they all signed a collective letter basically calling for the reinstatement of James Gunn as the director and writer as the Guardians of the Galaxy, kind of petitioning Disney, I suppose. They've had, I think, about 350,000 signatures from fans.
More now.
To get more, I'm sure it's going up by the minute, from fans saying they want James Gunn to be returned to this universe. Now, we talked about it last week.
We did.
And we were all kind of in agreement that we don't think he should have been fired.
I think any logical person would look at it and say you shouldn't have been fired.
That's what I loved about that statement. That statement was pure common sense.
Yeah.
It was like, we know they were stupid things to say.
Yeah.
We know they were terrible jokes, but they were jokes, and he already put his hands up years ago, apologised for it, and said he'd grown as a person.
Mm.
So, have you gone back on what you said last week at all? You still think Disney are no bueno?
I don't think they're going to do it. I mean, like, as kind a gesture as it is for the whole cast and crew to come together and actually say, look, you know what, we really enjoy working with this man. He's a very decent man. Everything that's in the statement,
everybody says that about him.
Yeah, like, I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that he is a good and decent person. For 300 people or however many people it was who signed this thing and, you know, came forward to do it. You know, they can't be wrong. But having said that, you know, like, Disney, they are that controversial, and I said this last week, they are that controversy averse.
Yeah.
They will go out of their way to ensure that nothing will upset the apple cart.
Because it was the whole thing, wasn't it, when they're like, whether they're taking over Fox or whether, I don't know if that's gone true, but it looks like it's going to happen.
It's gone true.
But Ryan Reynolds was, I don't know what's going to happen with Deadpool, because that's really not a Disney movie at all.
Not at all. Now, I mean, there's a difference in something like, you know, say Deadpool, for example, which is a very dark, weird, messy comedy film that would never in a million years see the light of day in Disney. That's fine. That's one thing. Where Disney's kind of, I guess you would say, knee-jerk reactions, whatever you want to call it, where that comes in is in their staff. As in, if something is found on somebody that works for them that is going to have an impact on the product and going to have an impact on the end result for everybody else, they'll just say, right, you're gone, goodbye. Like, look what happened with Ellen in the 90s, or not in the 90s, late 90s, when she came out as gay. And then they had to put the disclaimer in front of the Ellen sitcom.
I mean, that was obviously ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was obviously ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 20-something years ago.
Exactly,
but you know.
So, like, I mean, it's just, that'll just, and even, like, Roseanne is an example. Like, they knew going into, and ABC owns Disney, or sorry, Disney owns ABC. They knew going into that, that Roseanne had
I think that was the issue. I think that they made a massive mistake going in and bringing Roseanne in, given she had said worse stuff before.
Oh, yeah.
Like Roseanne to her, she had actually said worse stuff before. That was a bit more indefensible, I think. But she's obviously got mental health problems, and they still brought Roseanne in. So the hammer that people are beating James Gunn over the head with, or Disney over the head with, or you know, all these Chris Pratt and all these movie stars over the head with defending them, are going, well, that's hypocritical because you shouldn't, you know, nobody petitioned to bring Roseanne back.
Yeah.
Well, the whole cast and crew of Roseanne didn't sign it.
Exactly.
Think to bring her back and saying, look, she's grown.
Yeah.
She was doing these mad YouTube videos and stuff. I think they're comparable because of it's Disney and because they're so close together. But other than that, I think that's it.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, that's, like, yeah, you cannot compare like for like. I mean, Roseanne, in the case of Roseanne, it was a racial slur. She put a public racial slur. She can say, oh, I thought she was white or whatever. That's a load of bullshit in my line. Sorry. With James Gunn, it was a joke. He made it.
He made a bunch of them.
He made a bunch of them. They were all terrible. He should feel embarrassed by them. He's apologised and tried to deal with it in the best way he can. He said them 10 years ago. I mean, Jesus, you and I, and everyone probably listening or watching this, has said something 10 years ago that they're like, God, I hope nobody ever finds out about
that. This morning.
You know what I mean? So, like, my point is that, like, in the case of Roseanne, she said this 2 months ago, knew exactly what she's doing. She said far worse.
Yeah.
And you don't see, as you say, you don't see John Goodman stepping out wanting to see her get back on. Yeah.
John Goodman kind of kept a dignified silence, which kind of spoke volumes.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, but that's why I was surprised that, you know, they all took their time getting together. It's always Zaldana as well.
Mm.
At first released a statement, or kind of released it, I think sent a tweet out saying, you know what, I'm going to take my time with this.
Mm.
But I love my family. I love my guardian's family. And, I think it's kind of sweet that they're defending him like this.
Yeah.
Gunn has already disowned all this stuff. I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. I know Dee did as well.
Yeah.
And I hope common sense prevails. Although that's not always the case in the corporate world.
No.
But I think the Guardians of the Galaxy movies are making too much money for Disney to do anything else.
Mm.
I don't know what other kind of director they're going to get in there, especially now given the cast publicly saying they want James Gunn back. I don't know what other kind of director they're going to get in there that is of that quality.
That sensibility.
You know, without actually backing up a truckload, a ridiculous amount of money, or just getting a journeyman in there who's going to get it across the line.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this before. I mean, basically, any director who tries to get to grips with this now, it's a poison chalice. It's as simple as that. Because you have a cast and crew that don't want them there. You have a fan base that doesn't want them there either. I mean, Christ, like, I mean, you could get Christopher Nolan in to direct Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Not that he'd be a terrible choice, but you could literally get the best possible director in for this, and people would still be like, "Oh, well, James Gunn should have done it." You know what I mean?
It was his vision.
It was his vision, and it's so intrinsic.
And I love you were talking off air, and you mentioned as well, like, James Gunn, an integral part of the Guardians of the Galaxy universe, obviously was the cast, and Chris Pratt became a superstar off the back of it. That was the movie that really launched him.
Yeah.
And was almost a guy from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as well, wasn't it? He's got a sitcom on NBC now, so I don't watch It's Always
Glenn
Sunny.
Horton.
Yeah,
Glenn Horton.
Yeah, it was almost really? Him. Yeah, he came super close.
Couldn't have been him.
It became super close.
The
with
Golden
that.
God. You watch it?
Yeah.
Golden God.
I must start watching it. I've never watched it.
It's so good.
Yeah,
oh, geez, you love it. You totally love it.
I feel like it'll be right up your street.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't watched it.
I'm going to watch this and be like, wait a minute. That's insulting. What were they saying? Anyway, the soundtrack. The whole playlist and all that mechanism.
Yeah.
That plot mechanism of, okay, this is something that really...
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It fits so beautifully into the character and in the universe.
Yeah.
And now it's synonymous with that universe.
Exactly. And again, that was pure Gunn. That was Gunn right from the get-go. He came up with this idea that there would be music to kind of carry it along that would have an emotional beat, an emotional connection. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, and that's right in his wheelhouse. That's right in his sensibilities. So
I don't know. We're going to move on to the revisit now, but... And like, I don't know if Dave agrees as well. I think he probably agrees with you. I think I can see it happening. I can see them taking a bit of breathing space with it, giving it a week or two, and then having James Gunn come back.
Would he want to, though?
Yeah.
I'd say he would.
Imagine having created that entire universe.
Yeah, it's the suits that have an issue with him, not the...
Not the
they don't even really have an issue with him. They have an issue with the reverberation of what he said 10 years ago resurfacing. That's it.
It's almost like they're punishing him as if he did it 10 days ago rather than 10 years ago.
But I mean, I don't know. If it was me, right, this is just it. If it was me and I was chucked out like that after doing, you know, admitting what I did was wrong, having done all that and having made Disney that amount of money, and then you're literally just dropped at the...
Yeah.
I'd be like, no, screw you. I'll go somewhere else. Literally, I would be of the opinion.
I would guess that the cast and stuff have all been in contact with him, and
you know,
obviously not publicly, but have been in contact with him about that exact thing. Mm. You know, like, does he want to come back? I would guess he obviously wants to come back. You know, he's been mute on the social media anyway, and he's only very vocal. So look, we'll see what happens.
See what happens. Yeah.
Hopefully, it doesn't happen before Friday.
Yeah.
Before we're going to look like ticks.
Good morning, Mr. Phelps. This is your mission, should you choose to accept it.
All right, Brian. Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible.
Yes.
A very different film. So it'd be funny,
different.
But I think it'd be what would be really interesting is somebody who maybe got in the last two or three Mission Impossible movies, then hadn't seen the first one.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
They're kind of interchangeable for the most part, maybe with the exception of the last couple. And what they would make of this, because it's a very different film.
Oh, completely. Like, I mean, you look at Fallout... And you look at this and if you didn't know any better, you'd swear they were two completely different franchises and two completely different worlds. And just, you know, like the sensibility that, like, say, Christopher McQuarrie brings to it, it's very structured, very layered, very expert action and very just all about the staging and the choreography. And it's all about that. Whereas you go and look at something like Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible, it's almost like some weird European psychodrama thriller. Like, I mean, literally, you know, that scene, and we talked about this off air as well, the bit when he goes into the restaurant in Prague when he's talking to Henry Czerny, and he's like, that whole sequence, the way that it starts off just completely normal, him back and forth, and then he's like going around the room pointing out all the other different IMF agents, and then as soon as it turns, when he's like, you know, I know it's you. I know you were the mole. And then the camera just completely flips. Like, it starts to... Does the Dutch angle thing.
Mise en scène.
Dee
would know that because she has a master's in film.
Yeah. Periodically, if you could just point out your qualifications there, Deadpan Dave.
I actually studied film as well, a bit.
Did you?
In my undergrad. Not from my master's.
I thought you were going to say in your underwear there, like you read Empire in your joint.
Oh, no,
I did that. We've all studied film.
I never wore my jocks reading Empire.
But yeah, like, I mean, the way that De Palma kind of approached Mission Impossible, I think, was the fact that, you know, he really used the camera as a part of each and every scene. But
that's something that De Palma's done for...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you look at, like...
Entire career.
Like, you look at Carrie, you look at Blowout, you look at Scarface, he really does know how to kind of move a camera and bring everything around. And also, as well, another thing that Brian De Palma is able to get really well, I think, is tension.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He's able to just ratchet everything up really, really quickly.
There's that sequence in Untouchables with the buggy.
With the boogie going down the steps. Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
obviously from, you know, another movie.
The Union Station thing, and that was from Battleship Potemkin, I think it was. But yeah, he's really able to kind of get a sense of tension and just really just draw everything out from it. And again, just going back to that restaurant scene, because it's my favourite scene.
With
in
the aquarium, that image of Tom Cruise.
Yeah, running like this. And then the water coming down. But another scene in it that I love is when they go in, because this is the thing I really love about Mission Impossible is the script, and it was written by Robert Town, who did Chinatown.
He worked on Days of Thunder.
Yeah, he's like was kind of working as a script doctor. But there's a great scene later on in the film, and again it's Henry Zerny because I love him. He's such a good actor. He's so
Henry Zerny again.
He was Kittredge. He was the IMF director. Like he was the guy who was tracking. Ethan Hunt. He's called, these guys are ghosts. We trained them to do it, for Christ's sake. And then he's all like, so what are we going to do? Everyone has a pressure point. You just find what they want and you squeeze. And it's like, it's those like really like very like just 90s espionage dialogue that you just don't hear anymore. You know, like the whole thing, I was like, you know, what was the line where he's talking about when he puts the chewing gum and throws it on the oak? It's all like, you have bribed, cajoled, and using loyalties on the insides. You want to shake hands with the devil? That's fine. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell. Like, it's just stuff like that.
Very good, isn't he, Dave? Like, with the, yeah, you're like, with the, I'm terrible at remembering quotes properly.
But, yeah, I think it's a really smartly made, so over the top.
Handled the effects really well. You
very
that,
well.
That train sequence.
That age is, like, this film is like what, 20?
95.
So what? What are we talking?
23 years old.
Years, yeah. Still looks amazing. Still very well handled. CGI is subtle enough that it doesn't look like it's aged badly at all. Brilliant. Brilliant. The whole entire sequence is so well done.
I must give it an L revisit.
I've heard of that phrase.
You watched it recently?
Within the last year and a half, because I think the first time I saw it, I was
like a kid, yeah. Same as like
maybe 8 or 9, and
I saw it in the cinema as well.
Twists and layers, I had no notion what was going on. I enjoyed the lowering down and the knife part and the helicopter, but like,
yeah,
I was just gone. I was quite sad to see Emilio Estevez bite the bullet.
Yeah,
because obviously,
early.
As a child, Mighty Ducks was very important.
This is true.
And, that
flying
was
V,
all of us, all of us. Right. I love that they made an actual hockey team called the Mighty Ducks in Anaheim.
Like, yeah, the Anaheim Ducks.
I know, but like it's a moderately successful ice hockey kids movie franchise.
I know, that was very successful.
The Mighty team
Ducks
was already there.
Yeah.
Was the team? Oh, yeah, but they did not rename
them. It was
them.
The Anaheim Ducks.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But that's what they called them, the Mighty Ducks.
I think they might still be the Ducks.
Yeah. They are still the Ducks,
know.
Yeah.
But I know they definitely wore Sports Mighty Dave Ducks jerseys for a while. Ice hockey wouldn't be my forte.
Let me tell you, like this is, I don't know how I know this, but I know this, okay? Anaheim Ducks are still going, and in fact they actually brought back the original, remember the green, like the dark green thing with the they brought back that jersey, because like apparently the NHL now has 3 jerseys. They have like the home away, and now they've got like
the extra away
whatever you want to call it. And for the Anaheim Ducks, they brought back the old logo and the old
green
design.
Purple and gold.
Green, purple and gold. Yeah. I was tempted to buy it, let me tell you.
They look great.
They do. Like,
it
was
just
really
like looking like Kevin Smith, he lost a ton
of
weight.
That's it. You see, that's kind of it. Like, you can't wear, like, Irish people can't wear hockey jerseys. We just look like gimps. Like,
yeah, I actually went to a game at Madison Square Garden, the Bruins versus the Rangers. And they stopped the fights now after one fight. They let them fight once. And then they stop all the fights. And I was only there for the fights, to be honest.
The whole thing was just like...
Yeah, they're hard bastards, those hockey players, aren't they? They're tough as hell. I think I missed my call on it. I could have been a goon.
Yeah, but like...
No hand-eye coordination at all. Or any skill set to speak of. But I could have been a decent goon.
There's a great documentary on the goons.
The Last Enforcer.
The Last Enforcer,
It's on Netflix, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I have seen that, producer Dave. I saw that documentary.
I thought it was brilliant.
Useless.
I saw Red Army though. Red Army is a great documentary about ice hockey, about the Soviet Union's ice hockey team in the 70s, and how they were basically like controlled by the KGB. It's hilarious.
And
not hilarious.
And steroids?
No. Funny enough, no. It's
that's a very important thing.
But the big thing with the Red Army, with the Soviet Union ice hockey team, was with the fact that they were basically locked into a camp for like 8 months of the year out in Siberia, and just like.
Play
the guy just played constantly, constantly training. And they had literally a team of KGB agents to make sure that they never got out. Yeah, it's insane.
That on Netflix. Must
that's on Netflix as well. It's a brilliant, brilliant documentary.
Lots of plugs for Netflix.
Yeah, there's another great one, actually. I don't know if it's on Netflix. It's called The Miracle on Ice. And it was from the 88 Olympics, I believe. Winter Olympics, should I say.
Yeah.
And it was like the Russians had that team now, that caliber, like top players, and they were heavy favourites all the way through. Mm. And I think the US weren't allowed to send professionals or something, so they sent college students.
Yeah.
And the college students, plucky young fellas, overcame.
Is that the movie? Is that what the movie Miracle is based on, with Kurt Russell, Gavin O'Connor movie?
Yeah, that's based on.
Ah, cool.
There you go.
A bit of voice hockey trivia towards the pod at the end there. I think that might have something to do with having producer Dave, who's also Sports Dave with the Sports Chronicle and via Pundit Arena and stuff. So you know your sports stuff.
I wear many hats.
Give us a different angle this week. Give us a different angle.
Dutch angles, as you.
Dutch angles, eh?
Dutch angles. Hey,
comes back around.
Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to Owen Ronan, who's going to put this together. And thanks to producer Dave for chiming in on the mic as well this week. We'll catch you next time.
Understand, you're very upset. You've never seen me very upset.
This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds.